This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
He views it as an insurgency that needs to be stamped out, not something that requires a political resolution.
That was Murthy Mabrouk, a senior fellow at the Middle East Institute, speaking about the conflict in Ethiopia. Details are coming up. Also, Burkina Faso's president, Roch Marc-Christian Kabore, is aging closer to winning Sunday's presidential election. And Kenyan activists say there has been a rise in violence against members of the LGBTQ community. All these and more ahead on African News Tonight. But first, our top story. Ethiopia's Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed today rejected international calls for dialogue to halt the fighting in the country's Tigray region. He has said the country will handle the conflict on its own as a 72-hour surrender ultimatum runs out tonight before his army assaults the Tigray capital, Mekele. Communications to the region are cut and it is not possible to independently determine conditions in Tigray. On Tuesday, UN Security Council member met and offered support to an African Union delegation heading to Ethiopia. However, Ethiopia's government says the envoys will not be allowed to meet with the leaders of the Tigray's People Liberation Front. Hundreds of civilians have died in the conflict, which began November 4th, when Ethiopia launched an offensive on Tigray following what it said were TPLF attacks on government troops. More than 40,000 people have been displaced, and aid agencies warn there is a looming humanitarian crisis if they cannot get into Tigray to help them. Abiy's government says its operation in Tigray is focused just on certain TPLF leaders. The TPLF, however, says it is a war on the people of Tigray. As we mentioned earlier, the Ethiopian government has rejected the idea of negotiating with the Tigray People's Liberation Front to end the fighting in the region. Murthy Mabrouk, a senior fellow at the Middle East Institute, explains to VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi the reasons the government has no interest in finding a political solution for the escalating conflict.
There could be a couple of things. The first is that he doesn't want a negotiation. He doesn't want an outcome where possibly things calm down and then everyone goes away and rearms and then you do it again in a few years' time. I think he thinks that this conflict can be won and easily won in a fairly short amount of time, and he does not appear to be open to handling it in any other way. He views it as an insurgency that needs to be stamped out, not something that requires a political resolution.
The international appeals for mediation from the US, United Nations, and around Africa and Europe have so far not gained any traction. The United Nations Security Council is discussing the conflict. Is there enough international pressure on Ethiopia's leader to de-escalate and resort to a peaceful solution?
I don't really know what international pressure could mean. The first thing is Ethiopians, I think, have traditionally not had a great view of international mediation because they feel it has not worked out for them well in the past. There are some people, I mean, certainly Abiy's government feels that there hadn't been enough international condemnation of the TPLF when it was in power for almost three decades. And it's unclear what international pressure could be brought to bear. I mean, you could be discussing sanctions, you could be discussing trade bans, you could be discussing embargoes. However, there is the rather delicate issue of, is this a conflict or is this an insurgency, in which case the situation is more complicated to solve.
Would storming the regional capital solve the conflict in Ethiopia?
Storming the regional capital, I think, would lead to an enormous loss of life. And I think that if Abiy Ahmed himself is careful, he will make the distinction between the Tigrayan people and the Tigrayan leadership. So I'm not sure that storming the capital may wind up giving him what he wants.
The TPLF accuses the Ethiopian prime minister of marginalizing their ethnic group since becoming a prime minister 2 years ago. Is that a legitimate grievance from the Tigray people?
The Tigrayans are not the only people who feel that they have been marginalized since Abiy Ahmed came to power. Earlier this summer, there had been a great deal of dissatisfaction among the various ethnic groups, especially when elections that were supposed to be held in the summer were delayed, government said, due to COVID restrictions. And the TPLF went ahead and held regional elections anyway in September, which Abiy Ahmed could have chosen to handle differently, but he wound up cutting funding to the TPLF leadership, and then allegedly the TPLF attacked a federal base. No one's quite certain whether that is accurate, but what is definitely accurate is that they took over federal military arms and arrested federal troops at the Northern Command. So there is a fair amount of ethnic rancor in Ethiopia. But the TPLF is the only group that has taken it this far. So I'm not sure that one can say that this is the only reason that this has happened.
If mediation is rejected by the federal government in Ethiopia, what is the way out?
There are people who say that the conflict is not likely to rage on for too long, because you have to remember that the TPLF does not have an enormous amount of support in Ethiopia, not anymore. So it's not likely that the rest of Ethiopia is going to rise up to protect the TPLF. But there are fears, of course, that it could spark other conflict in the country. And then the biggest fear, of course, is that that conflict could spread across the borders to Ethiopia's neighbors. To date, Sudan is being very deliberately neutral, and Eritrea says that it's being neutral, but there have been reports that Eritrea is attacking TPLF forces. Of course, Eritrea has its own unpleasant past with the TPLF. So it's very, very difficult to tell. But I do think that at the moment, what is clear is that the prime minister thinks this is a battle that he can win, and decisively, so that he doesn't have to do this again down the road. He can win decisively and fast. And I don't think he's looking past that.
That was Murti Mabruk at the Middle East Institute here in Washington. She was speaking with my colleague, Mohammed Al-Shinawi. The United Nations Children's Fund, UNICEF, says since armed conflict broke out in the Tigray region of Ethiopia earlier this month, close to 30,000 people have sought refuge in neighboring Sudan. The organization estimates that 15,000 children, some of them without parents or relatives, are among those sheltering in camps and registration centers and were at risk. Mavis Ochera in Ghana has more.
Even before the current fighting, at least 54,000 children lived in refugee camps in the Tigray region and 36,000 were internally displaced by natural disasters and armed violence. Access into Tigray is now restricted by the fighting and communications are blocked, leaving an estimated 2.3 million children unable to reach humanitarian assistance. James Elder is a UNICEF spokesperson for Eastern and Southern Africa. He says the conflict in Tigray has put no more stress on the health and psychological well-being of children.
In the Sudan, which is already going through its own challenges, it already has a lot of refugees. So they arrive there hungry, thirsty. We, of course, also have a global pandemic. As I say, some of them are traumatized because of what they've seen, whether it's because they've seen bombs or whether it's because they've seen family members injured. So as always, any child who is fleeing an area of conflict is under enormous stress.
Ethiopia's federal government launched an offensive on the country's Northern Tigray region 3 weeks ago, saying it was in response to an attack by the Tigray People's Liberation Front, which governs the region. The Ethiopian government says it is a limited military action against some members of the TPLF, while the TPLF leadership says it is a war against Tigray. Elva says UNICEF and other UN agencies need to gain access into Tigray and work without fear of attacks to improve access to water, sanitation, and hygiene services. Elder says his organization is working to ensure children get vaccinations and plans to begin a polio vaccination operation next month. Both sides need to keep children safe and not recruit them to fight. Elder says and children should be protected from sexual and gender-based violence.
Going to need to be on the ground, the United Nations, UNICEF, providing that nutrition, providing that emergency sanitation, making sure people have access to water. A lot of the water supply in Tigray requires sort of, you know, diesel pumps and so on. So got to make sure that there's fuel there. Cutting off a water supply can be catastrophic. So they're all the sudden emergency things children now need, as well as psychological support. We're getting children arriving in refugee camps in Sudan who've lost their parents.
Elva says his organization and other UN agencies fear the number of refugees crossing into Sudan to seek refugee was just the beginning, as there are concerns that the Tigray violence will escalates.
What UNICEF urgently needs at this point is to get access into Tigray to make sure we can reach those people as well, where there's, you know, more than a million children, we believe, who will need some form of humanitarian assistance. So as with all conflicts, whilst as long as it continues, the more likely we're going to see civilians and children suffering and fleeing.
Elder says UNICEF was particularly alarmed by malnutrition rates in the region, noting acute malnutrition increased by one-third between 2019 and 2020, largely due to the desert, locust infestation, and the COVID-19 pandemic. He says without sustained humanitarian access, many more children will be at risk, as malnutrition treatment supplies in the region will last only until December. Reporting for VOA, this is Mavis Autry in Ghana.
Burkina Faso's President Roch Marc Christian Kabore is edging closer to being re-elected despite opposition concern over the validity of Sunday's presidential election. The French news agency AFP reports the opposition's complaints included a failure to open some polling stations, the unprotected transport of ballot boxes, the lack of sufficient material and personnel in charge of the vote, and what they say were arbitrary changes in the mapping of polling stations. Despite those concerns, Reuters reports Kabore, leading his nearest rival, former finance minister Zephrine Diabaré, with over 593,000 votes. So far, with 58% of total ballots cast having been counted, Kabore is on track to secure enough votes to avoid a second round. Women's rights activists in Senegal say gender-based violence has increased during COVID-19. To raise awareness for the International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women, Senegalese artist Diart exhibits her own experience. Estelle Inyanjo reports from Dakar.
47 years old Senegalese painter Diart, who only wishes to be identified by her artist name, is a survivor of gender-based violence. The mother of two was born with two clubbed feet, a disability that made it hard for her to protect herself from her violent husband. Diart eventually divorced and uses her paintings to show the attacks and social stigma against abused women. She says she identifies with these paintings. I don't take the suffering of another, says Diart, but I take my own suffering. I'm trying to represent on a canvas, she says. So, through my brushes, my painting, as a committed artist, says Diart, it is my duty to raise awareness, but it is also my duty to denounce. Activists say gender-based violence has increased globally during COVID-19 restriction, and Senegal is no exception. Activist Dede Didi created the website Violence Against Women in Senegal after a close friend was killed by her husband. During the COVID-19 lockdown, she says, the platform has been flooded with messages from women in need. Didi says all the cases she received are women being kicked out of their homes by their husbands. They do it just to make life harder for their wives, she says. They do it just before the curfew to raise awareness of the abuse for this year's International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women. On November 25, Dayart is showing her work at Dakar's House of Urban Culture. As the event's opening Tuesday, the centrally located art gallery was filled with women looking at her paintings, which depict traditional scenes of women who are bloodied and bruised. University students Adama So praised the work for raising discussion on gender-based violence. She says this is a very good initiative because women need help. They don't need to be hit and mistreated, says So. They need attention and to be listened to. Dayart's painting will be on display throughout the 16 days of activism against gender-based violence, an annual international campaign from November 25 until December 10, Human Rights Day. Estelle Jonjo for VOA News, Dakar.
Kenya has acknowledged that COVID-19 restrictions are fueling cases of gender-based violence, but has been less open on abuse against the LGBTQ community. Homosexuality is illegal in Kenya, and activists say many are afraid to report abuse or get medical help because of stigma. Rael Ambor reports from Nairobi.
28-year-old Rebecca Adhiambo's family shunned her after discovering 2 years ago that she is a lesbian. When her neighbors found out, she was insulted, evicted, and in September, attacked. She says, I was from the market. I was going home to prepare a meal after a long day of doing casual work in Isili. Someone approached me from behind. A crowd gathered, and some were shouting that I should leave the neighborhood. They started beating me and threw away all that I bought. 34-year-old Said Athmani documents cases of attacks on the LGBTQ community. Since the COVID-19 outbreak in March, he says there has been a jump in cases of abuse.
Curfew is in place. People are told not to go to work, so they have to stay within their localities. So you find in our locality here in Pumwani, when people notice and recognize that in our neighborhood we have LGBTQ plus persons, they start to abuse them. They start to victimize them. Yeah, in a way that they feel that they don't want them in this community.
The Gay Lesbian Coalition of Kenya, GALC, says during the pandemic, they have logged up to 10 attacks per month on the LGBTQ community. Kenya's government raised an alarm on increased cases of gender-based violence, but has offered no targeted help for LGBTQs. Donna Awor is the security coordinator at the Gay and Lesbian Coalition of Kenya.
Inclusivity is still foreign to most of these mainstream organizations, and they try to sideline us because they feel like we don't deserve to be in those spaces. We don't deserve to get the opportunities or the resources that are available because of who we are or how we identify.
Kenya is considered to be among the most progressive African countries, but the High Court in 2019 upset activists by upholding a colonial-era law that punishes homosexual acts with up to 14 years in prison. Kelly Imathi is a programs officer at HIVOS, a development aid organization that provides financial support to organizations working in Africa, Latin America, and Asia that seek new solutions to persistent global issues.
It's been really difficult to engage the government in LGBT conversations, especially when you want to really, you know, bring the case out that you have a section of a population that is really suffering.
When asked to speak on LGBTQ abuse, Kenya's Ministry of Gender and Social Services referred a reporter to the United Nations Sexual and Reproductive Health Agency, UNFPA. Raya Lumbur for VOA News, Nairobi.
The coronavirus pandemic has wiped out an estimated 2 million jobs in Kenya, forcing many into the informal economy. Kenyans, however, also have a secret that is keeping many of them financially afloat, the largest cooperative savings and loan movement in Africa. With more than 14 million members making monthly contributions, Kenya's cooperatives offer loans during tough times, helping many to ride out the pandemic or even start their own businesses. Here's Mohamed Yusuf from Nairobi.
30-year-old Judy Muthama was selling shoes and utensils in the Mukuru Kwanjenga slum in central Nairobi. Sales were good until the coronavirus pandemic wiped out her business. But she's restarting her business with a $600 loan from a savings and credit union, where she has had a membership for 3 years. Muthama says that if it were not for the cooperative, she would have closed her business. She says it is a cooperative that improved her situation each time she ran into financial constraints. She says she goes to the cooperative to borrow money so she can continue with the business. Otherwise, Muthama says she would have been out of business long ago. Muthama is one of some 14 million Kenyans who are members of cooperative societies that depend on monthly member contributions to survive. Austin Oduor is the chairman of Uprising Housing Cooperative, whose savings union has 834 members. Since March, he says the union has seen an 80% drop in monthly collections, but is still helping members to get through tough economic periods.
Which they really appreciate, that the cooperative have worked with them in a number of things. We have given them the meal vouchers, the hand washers, the masks. We have given them some of them the loans to take back their kids to school.
Kristen Wilcox is director of a USAID program that works closely with the cooperative societies in Kenya. Wilcox says she admires the initiative that drives the groups.
So by their very nature, there is no one from the outside assisting these members to achieve their goals. It's purely based on their own energies and their own ability to collectivize. And I think that's really exciting because there's no man behind the curtain. There's no one who's there at the end of the day to take the bulk of the profits. What they are able to achieve is squarely their own.
Isaac Nyamongo teaches at the Cooperative University of Kenya and is a member of the Kenya Cooperative Coronavirus Response Committee. He says they have helped 44,000 people.
As a committee, we set up what we call a co-op kit. And in this kit, we provided some basic foodstuff for the vulnerable households. And within that, we also provided masks for prevention. And then we also provided within that kit sanitizers and soap. The whole idea was while it was important for us to provide food to the vulnerable households, we also wanted to give them a means with which to prevent infection.
The cooperative societies are likely to remain active in coming months. Kenya has eased restrictions which have helped open up the economy, but the increased number of positive coronavirus cases may slow the economic recovery. Mohamed Yusuf for VA News, Nairobi.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing The Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
The Voice of America's Global News Program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest news stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. Our correspondents gather the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 3:30 and 1705 UTC on The Voice of America.